Voices Radio Network.
Hey guys, Scott McNally here for the Advices Radio Network, and we are putting together a new program. So far, what do we have? We've got Dave Crossland, we've got me, and we've got a bunch of questions. So what do we call it? We're not sure. At this point, I'm going to call it the Dave Crossland Podcast. Dave, what's going on, man?
Yeah, are we even going to mention some of the ideas we had, or should we keep them quiet?
I think we had some good ones. I think we had personally come up with some not so good ones. I give credit to your wife for coming up with, in my opinion, the best idea, which was drugs and stuff. That was my favorite.
Yeah, I quite like that. It's one of them you said in a joke, but actually the more you think about it, the more you think, you know what, actually that's not that bad.
Well, you know, here's the thing, too, Dave. You're to me, you know, I've gotten to know you over the past few years, watching you on your YouTube, having you on my programs, and, listening to you on other podcasts. You are anything but pretentious. You're a laid back guy, and you don't take yourself too seriously. I feel like if we came up with this big, complex, extraordinary name, it just wouldn't fit for a Dave Crossland podcast, you know?
No, I don't. And I think people sometimes misunderstand a lot, you know. The only real thing I like to try and be is honest. Mm. And sometimes that's self-deprecating in a way, because the honesty is quite critical of myself sometimes. And people seem to struggle with that. They seem to not be able to get their head around that.
What do you mean?
Well, I just, you know, it's like, because I've been very open and I've been very honest and I've been very open about the bad times and the screw ups and the mess ups and the problems, I attract criticism. And it's like, well, these are no different to a lot of other people out there, but they just don't tell you about them.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know why people have this big issue with admitting you screwed up. We're human. We mess up.
It's hard. Listen, I get it. I get where you're coming from, and that's the bold thing to do. I can tell you that it is hard to fess up when you've made a mistake, you know, and especially somebody who's in the eye of the bodybuilding community. Everybody's looking at somebody and then they want to look perfect, especially say that they're a coach, maybe they've got some financial interest, all of that, you know.
I suppose I probably had an advantage because I started being honest when I was nobody. When nobody knew me. I mean, I'm not anybody now, but you know, nobody had heard of me. So I didn't have a reputation to protect.
Yeah, yeah.
But the irony of it is, though, those that then criticize these people for showing weakness are making mistakes themselves. I mean, none of us are perfect. We all screw up. We all make bad choices. We all make bad decisions. We all act out of vanity and image on times. We're all insecure to some degree.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so true.
What's the big deal with it? I mean, there was a post today on one of the social forums. It was something now about bodybuilders saying, oh, I'm a bit fat and full. I mean, I'm a bit fluffy.
Okay.
It's like, no, you're fat.
It's a very nice way of saying you're fat, right? Fluffy.
Someone said this last popped up, and granted, this girl had lost quite a bit of weight. Was still a bit on the chubbier side, but, you know, so what? Who cares? And she said, you are not fat. It is something, it's like you are not a toenail. You have toenails, but you may have fat, but you are not fat. And I'm like, no, you are fat. It's a descriptive term. It's not negative or positive. How you choose to take that is up to your pre-programming. But yeah, truth of it is, it's just a descriptive term.
Sure, sure.
If someone is carrying excess body fat, they are fat.
Yeah.
Why does that have to be a negative?
Well, we have so many connotations related to what that means. That means, okay, if somebody's fat, that means they're also what? They're considered by society to be lazy. They're considered to not have the willpower to do, you know, what it takes to be in good shape. You know, that they're somehow morally maybe not as good of a person.
No, it's they're big boned and have a glandular issue. But the point is, so what?
Yeah.
So what if I like eating cake and pies and I'm a bit of a lazy sod? Yeah. And big deal. You could even argue in reverse. I mean, take away the health implications. And I'm not going to, you know, I fully understand that, you know, obesity and high body fat is not healthy.
Yeah.
I mean, excess weight in any form, even muscular weight, is not healthy. We know that as well. But you take away the, you could say, yeah, okay, so I'm a bit chubby and I eat a few foods I shouldn't eat. But you won't even go out to a family event because you're too concerned about eating asparagus tips and your dried chicken and rice. Mm. And you spend your whole life obsessing over your food. So who's the most unhealthy there? Hmm. Because we have someone with a very unhealthy mental approach to food. And we have somebody who has a relaxed... I mean, the fat person... I remember a guy. He's called him Fat Mike for obvious reasons. He was huge.
Okay.
But this guy could hammer out hard on a cross trainer for an hour and a half.
He could what?
Hammer it hard on a cross trainer for an hour and a half. Oh,
you lost me with the accent there for just a second. Right. No, that's okay, because I'm sure that my accent is just as thick to you.
So, you know, he wasn't unfit.
Okay.
He was very physically fit. He just carried excess body fat.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, it's quite ironic, really, when you start looking at, you know, sometimes the criticisms people make of certain body types or certain lifestyles when they actually live a very unbalanced lifestyle themselves and quite potentially a very unhealthy lifestyle, just in a different way.
Sure, sure. Hey, if you're competing and you're competing at the high end and you're using the supplementation that we all do use to get ripped and shredded and look our best, I mean, a lot of that is not healthy.
Well, I mean, just that approach. How many people do you know? I mean, I've met hundreds in the bodybuilding world who have major eating disorders.
Sure, sure.
I know a pro. He probably wouldn't mind me mentioning his name, but I won't do it. He's retired now as a bodybuilder, but competes as a powerlifter. But he was very open about the fact he got to the point he could only eat seven foods. Because he was so paranoid about gaining fat. And, you know, so... Anyway, we've gone off on a bit of a weird tangent there, but I think that's going to be definitely a trend of this podcast. It's disappearing up alleyways we shouldn't really be going up. But yeah, I just like to be honest and open and a little bit more realistic about things. You know, I think there's a lot of trends in bodybuilding and training and stuff that are just complete fucking bollocks, if we're honest.
Yeah, like what, for instance?
Well, you get people that let's look at people will obsess over diet. Now, I'm not saying that diet isn't an important factor of growth. Obviously, it is. But if you're just training to look good in a t-shirt, why are you being so restricted and obsessive to the point where you're not spending time with your family, when you're not spending time with your loved one? When the chances are, all that's really wrong in your life is you just don't train hard enough. It's like people get so scienced over diet and so scienced over drug and then just go do four sets of 10 reps on this and four sets of 10s of that and think that's it.
Yeah.
There seems to be far too much focus on intricacies about certain aspects, and yet the big glaring one, which is training, everyone seems to ignore.
I could see that. Yeah. Same could be said for the drugs. You know, you get wrapped up in putting this perfect cycle together, but your training is subpar. You know, the nutrition isn't great. Training or nutrition isn't great. Gear isn't, great. Your training is good. You can still do something. I guess, you know what, though? I'll say it's all of it to me. I feel like all of it's got to be, you know, there.
I do think, though, you can outgrow a bad diet and bad gear if you train in sport.
Do you feel like you could also still make good progress with mediocre training and an excellent diet?
I think you would make some progress, but I think if we looked at 100% training, 50% diet, 50% drugs, that would make more progress than 50% training, 100% diet, 100% drugs.
Okay.
Because the primary driver in all this is the stimulation to grow.
Sure. Yeah. Without the training, then the food and the drugs are going to do nothing, right?
And one of the things that the old school guys say continuously off season, trained like a nutter, make sure I had enough protein, and then ate what the fuck I want.
Hmm. I like that word you used. We don't use that over here in the US, nutter. That's a good one. That means like crazy person, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I'm translating for the US listeners.
It's a common trend when you speak to the older guys, you know, the 80s bodybuilders and such like. The common trend is that they trained incredibly intensely, be that high volume, low volume, high intensity, whatever their chosen way was, they didn't leave the gym till they'd given it their all.
Yeah.
And they made sure they got plenty of protein, and then the rest of it was pretty much filled up with whatever.
Hmm.
And they still growed very, very, grew. My apologies, grew very well.
And the guys back in the 70s. Their nutrition wasn't perfect, like Arnold and them, you know, but they worked out 4 hours a day and they trained hard.
I think we've over-scienced it to some degree. And in that, it's lost its enjoyment. I mean, there's also, bodybuilding isn't for everybody. And that's all right. You know, we seem to have tried to generalize the sport to include as many people as possible. And as a result of that, some people just aren't cut out for it. But the result is then that's actually pushed drug use up. Because some people just aren't built mentally or physically to give it their all in the gym.
Yeah.
So they'll try and compensate by increasing the drug intake or by being more anal over the diet and such like. And I just think, are we trying is the overpopulization of bodybuilding actually causing more health problems than when it was just left to those that truly wanted to do it?
I could see that. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I was at one of my old job, and there was a younger girl working at a grocery store. And I would go to these different grocery stores and set up displays and drop off product and stuff. And this girl said, "Hey," and I did coaching on the side at the time. She said, "Hey, you coach one of my friends that I went to high school with." And I said, "Oh, you know," and she mentioned his name. And she said, "It seems like everybody from high school is competing now, that's the thing to do."
Hmm.
And yeah, if everybody's going to be attempting this because that's what's popular, then sure, you're going to have some people that aren't going to be, like you said, as cut out for that. And so what are you saying? That gives them then, say, a reason to then try to make up for those poor genetics by increasing using more drugs?
I think it's not even poor genetics to some degree. I just think it's a lower desire.
Oh, okay.
You know, I'm sure I could do various things if I wanted to do them enough, but I don't desire them to do them enough, so I don't do them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's what's happened with bodybuilding to a large extent now, is there's a lot of people involved in the sport because they like the idea of it. But they weren't introduced to it the way we were traditionally, which was through the gym or hard training. They were introduced to it via images online.
Yeah.
And got wrapped up with diet and drugs because that's all that's talked about online, and missed that memo about the fact, oh, hang on, you need to leave your soul in the gym by the time you're finished.
Yeah, every time, every day.
That's not to say that there's anything wrong with training at a lower intensity or training at a lower level, but my point is, you're supposed to enjoy this shit.
Yeah.
And if you don't enjoy it, why the fuck are you doing it? I'm not saying that comp prep and starving yourself and trying to get down to, you know, single-digit body fat levels is enjoyable. It's not. But the reward of standing on stage must be worth the suffering in between.
Yeah.
But if you don't enjoy training in the first instance, and that's a chore, then why are you even doing it? Try and find something that's going to give you that health benefit that you find enjoyable.
You know, too, Dave, something I want to add to that is that if you are in that situation and you don't love it, if it's not your thing, there's nothing wrong with that either. You know, and it doesn't make you a worse person. It doesn't make you less of a person if it's not what you want to do. I have a feeling that most of the people listening to us right now do want it. You know, they're seeking out the tools to be better, and they're surrounding themselves with education. And that's, to me, I think what podcasts do. When I worked the job I mentioned, I was able to continue educating myself all day long at work through listening to people like you on these podcasts all day long. So I do agree, but I don't know if that's going to be our audience here. We're not, you know, YouTube. People aren't stumbling upon us. They are seeking us out.
Bloody hell, I've never been sought out in my life.
Well, you have now. You have now.
Yeah, we've gone off on a bit of a tangent there. We started so far by probably being rather negative about the whole sport of bodybuilding.
It happens.
It does. It just seems to have lost. You see more many people, they always seem to be people complaining about any of these days. There don't seem to be people actually enjoying what they do anymore. And it's like, seems to have lost where you need to be with this, guys.
Mm. I love this sport. And that's what I try to do with the shows is I try to express that, and I try to share that with people. And it helps me to hold on to that. When I get wrapped up in the minutiae of, say, the last 4 weeks of a contest prep, and if I'm not feeling it, I remind myself of the reasons why I started. You know, I take myself back to that place, and that makes me feel reinvigorated, and it reconnects me with what this is all about to me. Speaking of which, let me ask you, this would be a good place to kind of start out and kind of spin us into a positive direction too. I've never asked you, Dave, when you started training, and how did you first discover, and I'll just say weightlifting, not even bodybuilding, but how did you discover the art of weightlifting?
I played rugby at school, and I was a big lad, but I wasn't particularly fast, and I wasn't particularly strong. I've never naturally been particularly strong.
Okay.
And I was basically told I needed to get quicker, and I needed to be more powerful. My brother had done a bit of weightlifting in his time. He was into a bit of boxing as well. And he had a set of weeded dumbbells in the basement of the house.
Ah.
And I just started messing around with them. Now, I'd always been very, very fascinated with like superhero physiques and that sort of, you know, cartoon-like overly muscular body. And then I used to religiously buy Flex and Muscle and Fitness, and I'd cut pictures out and pin them all over my wall. Bit of a sad nab that way, really. And obviously predominantly the sport in the UK was what you would call a soccer, what we still call football.
Yeah.
But I wasn't particularly good at that. I was okay at rugby, but it was more just I was bigger than the other kids than anything else. But this was something that I found I could do quite well. And I was a kid that never really excelled at sports. So, you know, I'd never particularly liked PE and the physical ed at school, and I just sort of got by with it. But here was something I found I was quite good at. But the other thing was, I don't know why, I had a very regular child upbringing. I had lived with both parents, middle of the road, and there was nothing particularly odd about my family life in any way, shape, or form. But I enjoyed the pain. And it just was something that I could do, something that I enjoyed doing, and something that I enjoyed very much the process of doing. And I never really got into this initially out of a desire to step on a stage. Yeah, I liked the big muscle physiques, but it was more I just enjoyed the process.
Yeah.
And I, for a very long time, and quite naively so for a very long time, it's quite ironic when you sit and think about where I've been and what I've done at this point, thought the only difference between me and one of these guys that I was seeing in the magazines was that they trained harder than me.
Hmm. Okay.
So the only thing standing in between me and being massive was training.
So you knew nothing about, we'll call it the dark side at that time.
Not for a very long time. And I ate a lot. And I made the mistake of thinking that weight was muscle size, and I got very fat, but I did get quite strong. For a natural junior kid, I was quite powerful. And then I decided I wanted to compete. And when I started dieting for the show, I was just gone 18. And I was in UK, I was 23 and a half stone, which is, what's that, 150 kilo-ish. So we're talking 330 pound-ish, 330 pound.
Okay.
And I stepped on stage at 14 stone three as a natural, which again in American money would be, 14. About 200 pound.
Wow. Okay.
Shredded. I mean, I remember the last 3 weeks of that diet, all I ate was Castellan protein, casein protein, which was Castellan 90.
Okay.
The old product and cabbage.
And cabbage, huh?
That was it. That's all I ate.
Where did you get your nutrition information from at that time?
A guy called Kev Taylor, who was a British champion.
Okay. He liked the cabbage, huh?
I actually think he was just using me as an experiment to see how much he could actually get one kid to do. Because you got to remember at this point, I've got no knowledge about anything whatsoever.
Yeah.
So if you said to me licking dog piss off a thistle was going to make me grow and lean, I'd have done it. And I wouldn't have questioned it because I knew no different.
Yeah.
I honestly didn't know anything, but I obsessed over my training and I spent hours and hours reworking programs and playing with programs. And I was very, very lucky at that age to actually get to train with some pretty good bodybuilders.
Yeah.
So I got to train with Ian Harrison. I got to train with a guy called Billy Payne, who was one of Dorian's training partners.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I met Mike Quinn.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah, and a few others. He was as bonkers back then as he is now. I like Mike. I just got this baptism. And I also was very lucky in that I trained in a gym where you didn't bench unless you bench four plates.
Okay.
You sort of get talked to if you bench three.
So you got strong just by being in an environment like that. You had to.
Because I knew no different.
Yeah, yeah.
So to me, everybody bench four plates. Everybody squats six and seven plates because that was what I was surrounded by.
Yeah,
yeah.
I didn't know that the gym I was training in had some world champion powerlifters and some British champion bodybuilders and this plethora of high caliber athletes. It was just so and so at the gym. And so I got this real, in a way, unreal environment of what was actually average, but because of that I didn't have any boundaries, and because I didn't know about drug use particularly till I was in my 19, sort of touching 20s, I didn't know about overtraining. I didn't know about any restrictions. All I knew is if I trained hard and I ate enough food, I was going to grow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I kept getting stronger and bigger, but got a lot fatter with it. And then post that show, I didn't do anything at all. I had no interest in training. I had no interest in anything. I just so burnt out. And that resulted in me sitting at around 270 pounds, quite chubby. And then I was at university and I came back for the summer holidays, which would have been 10, 12 weeks back then. And I did my first cycle. And I went back to uni 10 weeks later, 19 stone with abs, with 270 with abs.
Wow.
And then just kept growing from there onwards. I peaked at probably about 24 years old. And then I tore my pec off and dropped away from training completely. But I had actually quite decent physique then in quite quite decent condition. Even Dorian, I don't think you'll remember, but I was introduced to him when he came up to open a gym local to us, and he'd actually took an interest and sort of suggested that if I could prove I could diet, which I was currently dieting at the time, that I would be taken to meet him, and he would sort of take me under his wing and take me all the way. I then literally a week later completely detached my left pec major. That sort of ended everything. And I never really came back after that. Drifted away from training. I had a lot going on in my life, emotional relationship problems, and I had a fledgling business that was doing very well. So it was easy to get preoccupied in other stuff. I ended up being incarcerated 4.5 years. That resulted in me getting back in the gym, losing all the weight, and then got back into things. But yeah, I had not a bad old physique when I was 24.
Sounds like there's a lot of stories within this story. I'm taking notes because if we're going to continue doing this program, we can go through and I can pull those out as we see fit, you know, and
we'll
talk about this stuff. Just to kind of push us toward kind of formatting the show, we do have a bunch of questions here. You had put out a thread on Facebook, and I put out a thread as well. You got like 25 comments right out the gate, in no time at all.
I've got more than that. There's three separate threads. I think you only saw the one on my own feed.
Okay. Well, what do you say we take a quick break, and it'll give us a minute to kind of sort out what we've got for questions and come back and see if we can make some topics out of this stuff. What do you think?
Yeah, no problem at all.
All right, guys, we'll be back in just a second. Hey, what's up, guys? I wanted to take this break and give some credit where credit is due. He didn't ask me to do this commercial, but I am doing it. And that's because I'm grateful. So thank you, Dave Crossland. Thank you for your contribution here at Advices Radio. And thank you for your contribution to bodybuilding as a whole. Guys, you can check out more of Dave over at his website. It's crosslands.org.uk. That's crosslands.org.uk. Crosslands Harm Reduction Service specializes in providing concise, informative, and effective drug training to a wide range of professionals, as well as advising individual users. And be sure to check out his YouTube page. It's at UC The Freak. That's the letter U, the letter C, The Freak. So you can't miss him there. The guy's all over YouTube. All right, guys, we will get back to the program in just a moment. Hey guys, Scott McNally here.
And this is VJ Peary.
You guys know us from here at the Advices Radio Network. Well, we also have another show, Bodybuilding Nerds Radio. We've got everything from supplement reviews
to shout outs,
listener questions,
and of course, our weekly bodybuilding podcast reviews.
So check us out every Friday.
Or whenever you feel like cooking or doing your cardio or basically wasting time with us.
You can hear us at bodybuildingnerds.com.
Also on iTunes. Bodybuilding Nerds, it's time to get nerdy.
All right, guys, and we are back. Dave Crossland here with me, Scott McNally. We are on the Advices Radio Network, putting together, as I'm calling it for now at least, the Dave Crossland Podcast. Yeah, it doesn't have a bright ring to it, Dave, but it says what it is, at least, I guess.
Working title.
Working title, a.k.a. Drugs and stuff. So we both posted up a couple of threads on Facebook. David posted three of them. I posted one on my personal page just to kind of gather up some questions and, you know, get some feelers out there for things that people might want us to talk about. The first question that we were going to get to, because this is something that fascinates me, you know, I mean, everybody who's listening to this now, we all know who Dave Crossland is. You guys have been listening to the Advices Radio Network. You've heard the shows that that, you know, I've done with him in the past. He's a guy who sits well above 300 pounds without even trying, really. And he's pushed as high as 415, which is, that's a mark that it's kind of like going to the moon. You know, most people are just never going to have that experience. So this first question that we're going to tackle is something I think is pretty interesting in regards to that topic. Gentleman asks, what kind of food does it take to reach that level of size? And it seems like a simple question, but this has got a lot of facets to it, I'm sure, because I can tell you, I can eat all the food in the world that I want, and at a certain point, I just can't eat anymore, you know, and that's where it ends for me. I'm sure there's some nuance to this. I don't know what the secrets are, but that's where I'm going to shut up, and I'm going to listen.
That's where you go wrong, because you said you can eat to the point where you know, that's it, I can't eat anymore.
Okay.
And that's the point where the hard work starts.
Mm.
It's the same if you think in the reverse of you prepping for a comp. You'll get to a point where the diet is relatively okay, and yes, you know you're restrictive, but you know, I can cope with this, I can live with this. And then when you want to get to that true leanness, that's when the suffering starts.
Yeah.
Well, it's exactly the opposite, but with the increase of food, the difference is that the suffering within the bulking lasts a lot longer. The first thing I think is that people need to understand, it's not an excuse to eat shit. And though I might not have had the most aesthetically pleasing physique, and I may not have been far from the leanest, it wasn't through eating crap. So the first thing is, your food has to be clean. The second thing is, it has to be very low in fat. And the reason for this is, when you're eating 8,000 to 10,000 calories a day, if you're running a 40-40-20 split, then you're whacking in a huge amount of calories from fat.
Hmm.
Way more than you actually need. So when you only need sort of 200-300 calories from fat to maintain basic normal functions, why would you be taking in 2,000 calories from fat? It's excessive and it's pointless. So one of the things that you need to start doing is looking at reducing the fat levels in your food as much as you can.
Mm.
And one of the ways for doing that is to use a slow cooker.
Okay.
Because it will pull the fat out, the fat will slope on the surface, and you can just skim it off with a paddle or a spoon, however you want to do it. So that's one thing. The other thing with that is it will actually massively help the lipid issues that you're going to get from the gear cycles you're going to be using.
Hmm.
The second thing is, you are going to eat. And forget about appetite, forget about hunger, forget about pleasure of food, because all that's gone out the window at this point. It's a function, and that's all it is. It's a means to an end. There is no pleasure in it. There is no enjoyment in it. You just get it down one way or the other. And it has to go down. Now, yes, you do need to look after gut health, and you have to look after your digestive system. But you are going to be bloated at the end of the day, and quite substantially so. We will get to the point where you are just literally opening your mouth, putting food in, and swallowing it down with water, because you cannot do any more than just that. But it has to go down, and it's the problem with it is, and why it's so soul destroying, is that it never leaves you. So at my biggest, I ate every hour and a half.
Wow.
Day in, day out.
Now, I take it you had to do that in order to get in your daily caloric total. That's what it required.
Yeah. When you're pushing that far above your baseline. You know, when you're 150 pounds in excess of where you should really sit, that's a huge amount of food.
So if you're eating every hour and a half, give me an idea of what one of these meals might look like.
Very, very simple. 100 grams of rice and 300 grams of meat and 60, 70, 80 grams of broccoli. Though as you start getting into the high levels of food, you'll start to drop down on the veg and switch to a greens drink. Because it's volume then, which means you can get more carbs and protein.
Ah, interesting.
So there'd be 10 meals of that in a day.
So 100 grams of rice, how many carbs is that? Because I do cups and ounces.
All right. So you're looking at about 85 to 90 grams of carbs per meal, and you're looking at in excess of 1,000 grams of carbs a day from solid food.
Okay. So we're talking 2 cups of rice every hour and a half. And then protein-wise, what did you say that was? 300 grams of protein? How many?
300 grams of meat is going to be taking you 60, 70 grams of protein, depending on meat source.
Okay. So another 8 ounces, say. That's a lot.
Yeah, you're looking at basically 1,000 grams of carbs and 800 grams plus of protein from solid foods.
Whew.
And then you're looking at probably another 100 grams of protein from drinks, probably another 100 grams of carbs from drinks.
That's a lot of food, man.
So you're already just on the basic carb content hitting 8,000 plus.
Yeah.
You know, for carbs and proteins, you're already hitting 8,000 plus. And then you've got the other calories contained in that food from the fats and traces and everything else that's with it.
Is rice your go-to in a situation like that?
Just less volume is for me, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd have potato now and again, but generally I stuck with rice. The problem is as well, when you're prepping that amount of food, you haven't really got the resources or time to get fancy with it.
Hmm. Yeah.
So it ends up being very, very plain. So my go-to was salt, pepper, and soy sauce.
Okay.
Everything got drenched in soy sauce. I used to buy soy sauce in like 2 liter drum and get big tubs of the stuff and just go through it constantly. But yeah, I mean, it was just everything I did. My food went with it. Everywhere I went, I had a tub in my hand.
I bet. Every hour and a half, man. And that people have to remember too, you know, it takes a few minutes to eat. And if you're not hungry at all, it can take even longer to eat that meal. So I've had it before in my life where I finish a meal and then, you know, it's much closer to the time I have to eat my next meal. So if you only have an hour and a half between, it takes you a half hour to eat that meal because you're just so stuffed. You got to do it all again in one more hour.
Well, the problem as well was that I struggle with appetite or struggle to eat round training.
Mm.
So I had to leave nearly a three-hour window around training in order to train and then be able to be in a fit state to get some food down afterwards.
Okay.
So that caused the bunching up as well. Though it was very often when I'd not finish a meal or have a meal and a half left and get up at 1 o'clock in the morning, go back downstairs and finish that meal, then go back to bed.
And you did that every day?
Every day, 7 days a week. No cheats. Didn't want one. You really just, you know, a cheat would be the ability to miss 2 meals.
Hmm.
And that was the level of consumption it was at. And this is why you don't see many guys that are super, super massively big beyond the genetic structure, because it is so difficult to attain. And let's be honest, it is incredibly unhealthy to attain.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing healthy about that. And it stresses every part of your body.
Hmm.
From taking a shit right through to your stomach to everything is maxed out constantly.
That's where I found the most stress. I had worked up to 8,000 calories at one point, 8 to 9, somewhere in there. And I was using a decent amount of powdered carbs and protein too. I'd eat a solid meal and then I'd eat a shake of some type. And I did have a lot of fats in there as well, which that was probably not the best idea, but it helped me to push those calories higher. That's what I found though. My weak link was my digestion. My stomach started giving out on me.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is obviously fats can slow down the digestive process.
Yeah.
Or they take longer to digest. So really when you're pushing high food, you want to steer away from, I mean, I know fats are calorie dense, and I think a lot of people, in my opinion, and it's not my strongest areas of nutrition, I'll be the first to admit that, but in my opinion, that move towards fats is actually negative.
Hmm.
And the other thing is with the moves towards fat is that's going to greatly increase your insulin resistance.
Hmm.
And the one thing you need to be very protective of when you're trying to bulk is your insulin sensitivity.
Hmm. That's a good point.
And the healthier you can keep that, the better you're going to respond and the better you're going to partition nutrients are going in. And now a lot of people will say, well, why didn't you use insulin? And I personally think it's the biggest waste of time going.
You've mentioned that. You've mentioned that. Why is that?
You'll get huge on it, right? Absolutely massive. And then as soon as you remove it, all that size will just disappear. Now, Rich Piano, bless his cottons. Didn't mind Rich. Nice guy, actually. Met him a couple of times and always found him very sociable, very friendly, lovely guy. Talked a fair bit of crap, but was an incredible businessman. But the one thing he did say once, that, and he manipulated this quite a lot, that going into an expo, he would do a load on insulin and growth hormone.
Yeah.
And he'd turn up at that expo 20, 25 pounds bigger than he was prior.
Right.
And just as lean, because he basically supercompensated with glycogen and water retention within the muscle. And then after the expo, he'd stop the protocol, drop the 20 pound, be back to a more manageable weight, not look as big, but it didn't matter. He wasn't seeing anybody.
Yeah.
And that's what I've found with pretty much everyone I've ever seen do high-dose insulin or high-dose growth hormone protocols is off-season they look huge and look to remain quite good condition. And I found the same myself. And then when they dropped it, all they ended up being was a smaller version of themselves, but struggling to get any fat loss from that point moving forward.
Which it surprises me. Had you always believed this, or this, you know, I take it this is through experimentation that you came to this conclusion.
I went to Mylos when it turned to using insulin.
Okay.
And Mylos's attitude is take some and then take some more and then take some more. Oh, and then take some more. And it's like, what? Well, basically you get insulin resistant. So instead of dealing with that problem, we'll just take more insulin. And his protocol's in excess of 100 IU a day.
Yeah.
And I got huge, but there was no actual discernible muscle when it all went away. And that was the thing. So it looked absolutely enormous. And all right, 415 I didn't, but around 390, 395, I actually had still had some decent shape and a modicum of condition, particularly when you took into account the actual body weight I was. But when all that was dropped and all that intramuscular glycogen went and everything disappeared, I wasn't sitting particularly any more muscle tissue than I was when I was 365 just on gear and no insulin or growth. It's just not something that I see having effective results when you're using high dose. Where it is and can be effective is low dose. Little spikes here and there throughout the day just to help push a bit more food through your system, then I can see its benefits. But high dose, no. But people love it because they look big, they feel big, they get huge pumps in the gym, and they equate that to size because the condition hasn't changed or not changed dramatically, so they think they're getting bigger. But when you see them stand on stage that next year, you'll see very little change in the stage weight. So, yeah, not a big fan. But anyway, we've sort of gone off from where we were. But, yeah, eating, to me, was by far the hardest thing of it all. Drugs and drugs toxicity wasn't pleasant, but it's just what you deal with. Training was hard, but it was only for an hour and a half, 2 hours max. The eating followed me everywhere I went all day long, every day.
Yeah, it would have to. You can't take a break from that.
And you get well known for turning up with a cool box in your hand.
Yeah.
And don't think you're walking around with a fancy six-pack bag when you're eating at that level because it don't fit. You're walking down with a family-sized camping cool box.
You know, somebody else asked a question that kind of relates to this, and I can't find the exact question offhand here. I'm looking through them. But the gist of it was dealing with physically being big. I mean, obviously, the more weight you gain, the more the harder it is to do everything, really. I've never come close to your size. I can tell you that when I get above 225, that's when I start feeling it. I can tell it's like it's difficult for me to turn and put my seatbelt on compared to, you know, when I'm when I'm below that weight. Obviously, man, you pushed to almost, you know, twice that at your highest. Can you talk on that topic? Because I think this relates and this goes along with that psychological part of, like you said, you know, when you diet down, that's a short thing and you can see the goal at the end with the off season, with growing. This is a long time. This is a long process. This is a long time of dealing with those meals day after day and feeling bloated and expanding your body. What's that like?
There's two aspects to this. There's the constant physical pain from the training, and that is constant. Then there's the constant stresses and issues that being that size puts on you in everyday life. Obviously, fatigue is a big issue. Constantly wanting to sleep. Cardiovascular ability, I don't care how fit you are, when you start getting that far above your natural levels in size terms, in body weight terms, moving around starts to become more difficult. I know Jordan's quite open about this element of him being the size he is. Kareem put a post up not so long ago. This is Jordan Peters, by the way, for those who don't know. Kareem is missing, put a post up not long ago about the fact that they park the car 200 yards from the house because they live on the main road.
Yeah.
And she has to go get the car and bring it down to the front door so that he can just get out of the car and step straight into the car because he can't walk 200 yards up the road to get in the car. And that is how he gets. At my biggest, I couldn't touch the back of my ears.
Poof.
I couldn't turn my collar up or down on my shirt. I couldn't fasten a tie. I struggled to bend down and do my laces. I'd have to stand up and put my foot on. There was a point at my extreme biggest where wiping my ass became challenging.
You hear people say that. I've never spoke to somebody that's actually had that issue.
It was doable, but it was awkward. It's just, you don't fit. You don't fit in life.
Yeah.
So public transport of any form, bus, train, airplane, absolute nightmare. Because what they tend to do is say, oh, well, you're a big person, we'll put you on the aisle seat.
Yeah.
What they forget to realize is that means that half your back, your arm and your shoulder is now occupying right to the middle of the aisle.
Right.
So nobody can get past. Stuff like amusement parks, fairground rides, you're not going on them. You've even got to start looking at weight limits on various things as well. So certain lifts wasn't allowed on them. Even getting weighed, because there isn't a domestic scale that goes up to that weight. So I had to go down to a local paper mill and get weighed on their weighing scale.
No kidding.
Yeah. Cars. I had to change my car because it didn't fit in the one I had anymore.
Really?
And it was actually painful to drive because I was so far leaning into the middle of the car because there's a door on the right-hand side. Well, obviously, on your side world, it's the left-hand side, but in my world, it's my right-hand side.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a door there.
Yeah.
That doesn't move, so that forces me to lean even further over to the left to compensate for the fact that there's a door there.
Wow.
Silly little things. Furniture. It's not very forgiving, or you're not very forgiving on that.
Yeah.
Particularly restaurant furniture, garden furniture, things like that. That gets damaged very, very easily, very, very quickly.
Oh, I bet. I said, oh, I bet. Because I've seen bigger guys that could, break a folding chair, guys that are just overweight. And, I can imagine, anybody who's pushing up that high. I know that even at over here in Walmart, they have the carts that the disabled people ride around in, while they're grocery shopping. At Walmart, they have carts that are rated higher in weight because the normal carts wouldn't fit the average Walmart people that needed them.
The people of Walmart's even famous over here.
Yes, yeah. Do you guys have Walmart over there?
We don't, but they have a sister company that they own called Asda.
Ah, okay.
Is over here. But, no, and I mean, it's just day-to-day existence at that size is all-consuming. The amount of people say, oh, I want to be massive, and it's like, have you any idea how hard it is to exist being massive? And a lot of people, when they start to get just near, start to realize, oh, shit, this is hard.
Yeah.
And the thing is, the only way you're going to adjust to that weight is by staying at that weight or going above it and then coming back down.
Now, is that part of the reason that you wanted to hit 415 so that you could kind of create a new set point?
No, you know what? I never set out to be a weight, and a lot of people thought I got obsessed with Greg Kovacs because he was 400 pounds. And don't get me wrong, when I heard about Greg's weight as a kid, that did strike a chord. I wanted to get as big as I possibly could. But when you say to somebody, I want to be as big as I possibly could, they can't comprehend that. And even now, I mean, I'm downsized dramatically. I carry a lot less muscle mass than I used to. I'm a lot lighter than I used to be. And even now when people meet me, they go, Jesus, you're a lot bigger than I thought you were. And it's like, yeah, you just don't comprehend how big that size actually is.
Yeah.
When you start getting pros refusing to have the photograph taken with you.
did that happen to you?
Yeah, a couple of times. And the thing is, they've got far better physique than me, far better quality tissue than me, and probably effectively a lot bigger than me, and, you know, really. But just my sheer bulking clothes, they didn't want to be stood near me.
Now, I don't want to put you on the spot to name names, but can you tell me a situation where a pro actually didn't want to take a picture with you? How did that situation go down? Like, were you at an expo or something, and did you say, hey, can it.
I was at an expo. And I walked onto the expo stand, and the stand photographer said, oh, let's get a picture of you two together. And the guy turned around and went, you've got no fucking chance. I'm standing next to him. And he put, I think it was two bikini girls in between us or something.
Okay, okay.
So it could be a direct comparison.
Wow. Yeah, that's funny. Now, people are going to scour the internet looking for a picture with you. A pro and two bikini girls. Now they're gonna put it together.
To be honest, I'm not gonna say his name, but I don't think he'd actually be bothered if I did, because I did actually know him.
Yeah. Okay.
Branch was very uncomfortable and took a rapid exit. I don't know what happened there. I mean, even Rich, when I met Rich, that photograph of me and Mitch together, he didn't like that at all.
Yeah. Yeah. You're bigger than him. You were bigger than he was.
He just didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
He got cornered, but he didn't like it at all. But yeah, you know, existing at that size is not a pleasant experience in any way, shape, or form.
Let me ask you, like, relationship-wise, you know, you mentioned Corn has to pull the car up. So she has to be understanding in that relationship that, you know, this is what she's going to have to do if she's going to be in a relationship with a guy that has those goals. I could imagine there being a lot of situations where being in a relationship could be strained because of that, because of your size.
My wife is an absolute angel.
She had to be to put up with that, you know?
She supported me massively, even at times when she didn't want to. A couple of things I think that really, really ground the gears. One was the food. She hated the food prep. She hated the boxes going everywhere we went. She hated me eating out of Tupperware tubs with a spoon. She hated the gagging when I was trying to force feed and literally me throwing it up and then eating it again and all that sort of stuff.
Oof.
And the other thing was the attention. She wasn't keen. Now, I never really noticed it. This was the strange thing. I'd walk through a scenario and not really realize that people were pointing or saying anything. But she did. She didn't like that either. She didn't want to be that much of a public figure. Hmm. And people could be quite intrusive. I suppose the worst case scenario was when we went to eat a steak, and it was a 96-ounce steak. And there were people literally hanging over my shoulder with video cameras filming it.
Really?
Yeah. And you become public property to a degree.
Hmm.
There were some great people we met, and some really entertaining people we met, and then there were some fucking assholes, like there always is. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a massive strain in a lot of ways. And the one thing I said when the projects were finished was that it was time to support her in what she wanted to do, and you know, more family time and more stuff like that. Than I know all we do is ended up working all the time, to be quite honest. But. Yeah. But I wasn't going to get involved with projects that were that selfish again. And it is selfish. It's incredibly selfish.
Yeah.
And I do think if you're going to do that, then you have to have a partner who is very understanding, and even however much you warn them, however much you try and advise them on what's coming, nothing prepares them for the reality of it.
Yeah. Let's switch gears here a little bit now. And, you know, pick your brain on some topics that are, you know, you can obviously relate to still, but are going to be a little bit outside of, you know, just you and your size. Because right now, I think so far that's what we've talked about. We had a lot of people with a lot of questions. One that I've never heard somebody ask before, and I know that you did address it on the on Facebook. I'd be curious to talk a little bit more about this, though. Paul says, Dave, near the end of Under Construction 2, you have an underground chemist show you how to make a whopping great batch of test sip, starting with powder and oil. My question is, where does this powder come from? Who makes it, and how does the chemist get it? And he also adds, disclaimer, I'm not trying to make this stuff myself. I'm just curious. This is something that we don't really talk about, like making gear, on any of the podcasts. And it was something that you guys addressed, and you actually showed how easy it was in the film Under Construction 2.
Well, basically, the vast majority of raw powders will come out of China.
Yeah.
They are produced in chemical factories with the correct equipment. They're produced outside of license, generally speaking. Which basically means is the company doesn't have a license for, or definitely doesn't have a license to export it to whichever country it's going to. But quite often they just won't have a license full stop to manufacture the stuff, but they will have the, what is required to do so. They're not always particularly high grade, and they're definitely not very pure in the sense of contaminants. They generally don't go under a great deal of post-production scrutiny, because they're all done sort of on the side. But these companies are quite open in marketing and advertising. I mean, I must get literally half a dozen emails a week from powder manufacturers offering me this, that, and the other. And they are then shipped discreetly to whichever country they are ordered to. The biggest producer of underground lab gear is the UK. In fact, so much so that Australia has marked the UK as a problem, because pretty much all the gear in Australia comes from the UK.
Oh, really?
So it's the biggest importer of steroids into Australia. And Australia has similar laws. In fact, they have stricter laws than the US does when it comes to steroids.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah, they are very hot on it. There is a bit of a movement to gain more understanding and more support for users, but so far it's just a lot of talk and not really much action. Unfortunately, the legislation in Australia was driven by biker gangs. There was a report that mistakenly claimed that the vast majority of steroid sales was controlled by the biker gangs, and Australia has a big problem with biker gangs, and it wasn't. And it isn't, and it's since been proved it isn't, and so there is now a move towards having the law changed to sit similar to the UK. So that's where the bulk of the raw powders come from, and they're shipped in under the guise of baby powder, supplements, all sorts of different things. Now, generally, you're probably talking for a kilo of test powder, you're probably talking somewhere around $700. So test enanthate, 250 mg per 250 milligram per mil, 10 mil vial, 1,000 grams is going to cost you £700. So one vial is going to be 2.5 grams. So 1,000 grams makes 400 vials, give or take. So it gives you a rough idea of the costs involved when you raw ingredients, $700.
Yeah, that's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, so, you know, even with vials and labels and additives and everything else, you're probably talking anywhere between $3 and $6 for a vial of test enanthate to be produced.
And one thing, too, I think it's worth pointing out, you know, I mean, as far as a lot of people get the idea in their head, they're like, oh, well, I could just go out and do this myself. And yes, you could. I think that some of the companies out there may have better connections than I might when it comes to getting these materials.
Yeah,
You know, and that they may have, and they may not, but they may have a better connection to get something that is cleaner, more pure, you know, not contaminated or not in some way adulterated or cut. Versus, you know, when you're a guy like myself, who's just, you know, a guy who goes to the gym and trains, if I were to think to myself, hey, I'm going to try to make this myself, who knows what I'm going to end up with? You know, I don't have those connections. I'd have to rely on these random guys that contact me on Facebook every day, which, by the way, you can stop doing that, guys. I don't want to talk to you, but you know, it's not always, I think, as easy as it looks. And at the same time, if you knew the right people, it could be.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is with the importation of raw is you have no idea of what you're getting.
Yeah.
Now, in general, it usually is what it says it is. But, you know, there's obviously labs in the past that have produced poor quality gear or have produced gear that isn't what it's supposed to be. Sometimes that's intentional, sometimes that's circumstantial, and sometimes that's just accident.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, these powders come in unmarked, unlabeled, in as a bag of baby food, you know, and there isn't particularly common testing services where I can go take this powder and then get it tested to see what it is and what grade it is and everything else. Yeah. And mistakes happen, but more often than not, labs either get greedy or it's actually a supply and demand issue. You know, if you've got a supply of, say, you're producing 10,000 vials a week under your lab, and you have to produce 400 bottles of Masteron, and you don't have any Masteron raw powder because it got seized by customs, and you're not going to have any more for 2 weeks, do you turn around to your sellers and say, oh, I haven't got any, so you can't have it, and risk that they go somewhere else? Or do you think, you know what, I've got a kilo of test in the corner there. I'll shove that in for this week just to get me through, and then I'll put the right stuff in the next batch I make. So there's all sorts of things that lead to dodgy gear. And it's very similar to a lot of the recreational drug market, in that people start off and produce a very good quality product till they get a reputation for having a quality product. Then they slash the quality in half, run that until the reputation's ruined, and then all they do is change the labels and start again. And that happens quite a lot. And labs come and go on a continuous basis. But yeah, I mean, the actual raws themselves, the chemicals involved, so the benzyl alcohol and benzyl vernate, which is a solvent, they're not particularly difficult to get hold of. You can buy them in 25-gallon drums if you want. Vials, labels, again, easy enough to find, easy enough to get hold of. You know, you can buy pill press machines on eBay.
And this is probably the reason there are so many UGLs out there.
Yeah, I mean, the last count, and I would suspect there's more, but the last count, Customs and Excise had 400 addresses of interest in regards to the importation of steroid powders.
I'm surprised there isn't more, you know? I'm surprised 400.
I mean, they had 400 addresses that they had interest in, and not addresses that they could follow up on.
I see.
A lack of resources, a lack of time. Steroid enforcement in the UK isn't that much of a priority. We've had a couple of big heads roll over the last 6-12 months, but the bulk of them have either come from accidental discovery or they've come through the cybercrime unit where they've been tracked from online activity. The actual customs route isn't that common a route of discovery. It does happen, but it's not that common a route of discovery. Customs and Excise currently only give 1 day a month to specifically target steroid importation. Unfortunately, police in the UK stretched massively, and as a result, resources are used to generally either go for serious crime or what's regarded as more serious crime or what's regarded as easy result crime.
Yeah.
And when you've got a subject that, generally speaking, the police officer knows bugger all about, they tend to avoid it like the plague if they can.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it still happens, and sentences are slowly creeping up over here. It's still nowhere near the equivalent as it would be if it was a Class A. But we are seeing more and more manufacturers get prison sentences.
All right. I'm going to move on here. This guy doesn't have much to say. He just says T3 and thyroid. Fat burners are something that I haven't heard you talk much about, Dave. What's your thoughts on using T3 in a dieting phase?
I think it's overused.
Okay.
I think, unfortunately, because we have the resources available, we tend to jump on fat burners a lot quicker than we probably need to.
Sure.
I can understand in a competition scenario, because you're trying to attain a condition that you're not going to hold for very long. But in a general dieting phase, I'm not a fan of using fat burners because it's unrealistic. Because if this is a program of weight loss in regards to maintaining the weight loss, then why use a chemical that gives you an artificial weight loss, so to speak? Your lifestyle needs to adjust to this new weight loss in order to it be maintainable. But in a comp situation where you're not looking to maintain that, obviously they are very useful additions and very effective additions. Of them all, I would say probably T3 has the lowest level of side effects. Thyroid damage from T3 use is rare. Most people will recover quite well, even after quite prolonged periods of even a year or so of using T3. Even though T5s or the old ephedrine, caffeine and aspirin is probably the longest serving fat burner out there, it's probably one that has some of the highest level of side effects. Yeah. Ephedrine is, at the end of the day, an amphetamine. And anxiety issues and paranoia and those sorts of elements are very, very strong from that sort of use. And it's probably one of those that's generally regarded as being a very safe fat burner, when in fact, actually, it's got quite a sting in its tail and can really mess people's heads up. Obviously, you've got clenbuterol, which is muscle sparing. There was a couple of studies that tried to show that it supported some sort of muscle gain, but in the real world, it's negligible and not even worth bothering with. But it is anti-catabolic, so it's obviously a very good fat burner to look at using whilst in contest and prep. It works via a trigger through the adrenaline system. It's quite effective. Side effect wise, can cause some irregular heartbeat issues. So it's not a drug I'd look at using if you had cardiac issues, but generally well tolerated and generally well recovered from, obviously, shakes and such like. And this is a thing as well. People seem to get this hack up that it's shit, Clen, unless I'm shaking like a shitting dog. And that's not the case. These are side effects. They aren't necessarily going to appear in every individual.
Yeah.
And shaking isn't necessarily mean that it's good or bad, Clen. But Clenbuterol is a popular one. And obviously the big one and the one that creates a lot of controversy is DMP.
Absolutely it does.
And this is definitely an incredibly toxic compound. And put it in very layman terms, it's a carb blocker.
Have you used DMP before, Dave?
I have, unfortunately, yes. Okay. Hate the bloody stuff. I think I'm the only person in the history of DMP that gained weight on it, but never mind.
was it water weight or?
No. I gave time for the water weight to come off, and I was still a pound heavier than when I started.
What?
I don't understand it myself. It's a powerful fat burner. But it's a drug that very much needs respected. Now, a lot of people will quote that death rates don't occur until you hit the sort of 5 gram mark. But what you need to be very careful when you read studies looking at DMP and associated death is that quite often what they refer to as the dosage is the total active dose in the body. Now, as this is a 5-day half-life, you're banging in 500 milligrams a day, you're going to get up to quite a high total active dose in the body quite quickly.
Yeah.
Because that first dose is still going to be at 250 mg 5 days later. You've got 4 other doses of 500 on top of that, and then you've got that's only going down to 125 another 5 days later, and you've got another 4 doses gone in on top of that again. So it accumulates quite rapidly. I think it was something to do with the Society or Association of Poisons or something in America. I can't remember the exact organization that produced the study. but they actually showed a recorded death that was as low as 200 milligrams a day. But that was long-term use. So this person had been using this consecutively for quite a long period of time.
Which 200 is pretty low by our standards.
Sort of standard starter dose, isn't it? 200 to 300 mg a day is where you'd probably start most people.
Yeah, yeah. And I found that when I'd used it in the past, I used it more recently last year, I didn't go much above that. I think I went to 300 for a couple of days, but I ran a low dose for a short period of time. For me, it wasn't beneficial, but I don't think I want to use it again. But yeah, that shocks me that somebody could be reported as having died at that dose.
Yeah, and I mean, it's, you know, this is one person out of whatever I think it's in the 40s or 50s, the total recorded deaths. There's probably more, but that have actually been attributed directly to DMP. But it can happen. And yes, that is probably an anomaly, but that might be you. You know, it's always that risk. So it's not a pleasant drug. And unfortunately, for a large amount of the people that use it, they use it as an sort of excuse to eat foods they shouldn't really eat.
Sure.
But it is that conversion of carbohydrate into heat that is where the big issue is. So if you're going to take DMP and increase carbs, then you're going to increase temperature. And that's the mechanism of death anyway. So you've got to remember this as well, that DMP's impact on your body is very interlinked with how many carbohydrates you consume while you're using it.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you want to get hot quick, then you don't need to take a lot of DMP. But if you eat a lot of carbs, it's going to have an impact. So it's like a lot of things, respect it. It's not one I find of choice, and it's not one I think is necessary considering what else is out there. But it is effective. It is powerful. It's as simple as this, all right? I can put this in very simple layman's terms. If it's strong and it's powerful and it's effective, it's dangerous. And it's as simple as that.
Yeah.
Because the more powerful a drug is in its action, the higher the risk is associated with it. And it's as simple as that. So whatever you're taking, steroid, fat burner, anything like that, the more powerful its effect, the higher the risk is that it's going to fuck you up.
All right. I'm going to switch gears here. Let's see if we can get one more question in here for the show. And let's shift gears to something training related, because that's where we started talking about at the beginning of the hour. And I know that that's where a lot of your passion is nowadays, is away from the drugs as much and more into the training. This question's about rest days. Do you actually need to rest, Dave? What's your life look like as far as training when you're on the ball, when you're in a good groove, hitting everything regularly? How does rest play into that?
My favorite training split is a 3-3-on-1-off.
Okay.
Body split would be chest, triceps, hamstrings, back, shoulders, calves, biceps, quads, and abs.
Chest, everything twice shoulders, a week. Hamstrings. So you're hitting
chest,
legs,
tries, and hamstrings.
Oh, chest, tries, and hamstrings. And then what was the second one?
Back, shoulders, and calves, which back, is probably the hardest out of the 3 days.
Okay. And then what was the third again?
Biceps, quads, and abs.
Okay. So you basically are hitting upper and lower body every single one of those days.
Yeah, I don't see why there should be any differential in that, to be quite honest. I just feel that if you're going to train hamstrings effectively or calves effectively, then you're not going to train quads effectively in the same session. Just from the sheer fatigue because of the size of the muscle you're activating.
Yeah.
So if you want to hit those muscles as hard as they need to be hit, then to me, they need to be separated. I prefer a lower volume. So in that, a major body muscle group like chest would probably be getting somewhere between 12 and 16 sets, including warm-ups. Three exercises, two working sets per exercise. And I'd hit everything twice a week. So biceps 6 to 8 sets, triceps 8 to 10. Shoulders would be 12 to 15. It would be three exercises, one for the medial delt, one for the rear delt, and a pressing movement. I'd never do any direct front delt work. Unless I was coming up to an actual show, because they just, in nearly everybody you see, they're overpowered, they're overdeveloped, and they don't need to be. So I'd stay away from direct front delt work. And I'd like to hit everything twice a week. And quite often that means going into the next workout still sore. And people go, well, you can't grow like that. And I said, well, you can. But there's all sorts of factors that come into recovery. Yes, you do need time to recover. There's no denying that. How good is your sleep? How active is your day job? How good is your nutrition? All these factors play in. Yeah. But I've always been a great believer in keeping it quite simple, really. If I have a crap workout, all right, wasn't a good one. What's the next one like? Oh, that was decent. Oh, we're fine then. We carry on going. Oh, that was a crap as well. All right, what's the next one like? Yeah, that was shit too. Right, something's not right. Let's take a couple of days off and just see where we are.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. So you're saying listen to your body too. That's an important part.
But I think for the vast majority of people, they just don't train hard enough or often enough. Mm. And you know, you can train hard, you can train long, you can't train the both. And so many people go, it's not as bad as it used to be. Go back 5 years and everybody was doing high intensity.
Okay.
Particularly when Dorian peaked and just after, everybody was on the high intensity. And it's like, but none of you train high intensity. You know, Dorian was a very unique specimen when it came to the way he trained. And I'm the first to admit, I couldn't generate that intensity day in, day out in a gym.
Yeah. Okay.
And I train, I'd like to think I train pretty hard, but I couldn't generate that level of intensity. So I added a little bit of volume in to compensate. But the thing is as well, your effective training is going to be the training that you can give the most effort at. So if you're like me and you get anything over 8 reps, you start getting bored.
Yeah.
And you start thinking, fuck me, how long have I got left to finish this? I can throw the odd high volume set in, but every set, forget that. But then I've got quite a slow rep tempo. I've got quite a deliberate rep tempo. So my time under load is probably a lot higher than a lot of people would be at similar rep ranges. So I've always worked within the 6 to 8 rep range with one set at the end of that exercise that would be a higher rep number.
Okay.
Because I just lose interest. And then if I lose interest, I'm not going to train intensely. If I'm not going to train intensely, what's the point of me being there?
I've been the opposite with legs specifically, that I like the high rep stuff. Part of it is that I can't get a ton of weight on my back for, say, a squat, but I can, you know, I've looked at like Tom Platz, where he'll do, you know, he did, 225 for, 5 minutes straight. And I know what you mean, because I have a lot of friends that say that. They're like, I get bored, after 8 reps. And to me, I feel like, okay, this is where the set starts. Like, I got through those first 8, and now this next 8, with this heavy weight is where the actual action's going to be. And I found to get some good growth out of that. But
very much so. I mean, I think it's simple as this. If you imagine a muscle, and you imagine it's fibrous, okay? So when you start to work out, you start to affect the outside fibers, the surface fibers.
Yeah.
As they fatigue, you'll start to pull in more fibers.
Yes.
They will fatigue in two ways. They will fatigue through volume, or they'll fatigue through excessive load. So if you're lifting a heavy weight for a short number of reps, then the muscle will start to recruit deeper and deeper fibers to move that heavy load.
Yeah.
Or you can move a lighter weight over a lot of reps, and as those surface fibers fatigue early on in the set, it will start to dig deeper to bring more fibers in to recruit to move that load later on in the set. A lot of people report that they grow more effectively off higher reps in legs. And I think the reason for that is, in my opinion anyway, is that very few people, and I struggle myself with certain exercises, can train the same level of intensity on legs as they can on other body parts.
Okay.
Because it's such a huge muscle group and it is so demanding. And if you're honest about that, you think about the less time you trade, say, biceps or delts, where you threw in partial reps or you threw in force reps or you did a drop set. And then think about the last time you did that with a squat.
Well, you're going to definitely fatigue a lot more with the squat.
Well, the thing is, to push to the level of intensity that you can get, say, on biceps, the overall stress on the body is huge, much greater. It's much harder mentally to endure. It's much harder physically to endure.
You're saying with the squat?
Yeah.
Okay, because it's such a you're using so much more of your body to do it. Sure, sure. Yeah.
So you've got a lot more pain receptors activated because it's a lot greater surface area of muscle.
Hmm.
You're requiring a lot more energy. It's a lot more stressful on the body. And bearing in mind that the whole thing behind growth is that the body is naturally lazy, doesn't want to do this shit.
Mm.
It goes against our natural instinct to endure and induce pain.
Yeah.
So what's more effective? Well, if you can't train at that high level of intensity in low reps on legs, which 98% of people can't, then you're going to get more growth out of higher reps because your overall intensity is going to be greater. Because you can push further because it's a lighter load.
That's exactly what I'm saying too. Yeah, yeah. Because so, I can't handle that. I've seen that picture of you with, I think you had like 6 plates on the bar squatting. Seven. Okay, yeah, I've never done that in my life.
And even, you know, I remember that. There's a little side story to that. I came out of that squat and the owner of the gym slapped me around the back of the head and gave me a bollocking. And I thought he was pissed off because, you know, I maxed his bar or bent it or something. Because it wasn't particularly the best bar I was under at the time.
Okay.
And he went, "What the fuck are you doing with 3 squats?" And I said, "Well, I was just a bit concerned. I hadn't been up that heavy for a while. I was a bit concerned if it went Pitong." And he's like, "Well, what the fuck are they going to do? Because if he touches it too soon on that side, he's going to fuck you up even worse."
Oh, yeah.
The rack is for. If it goes wrong, you put it in the rack. And I was like, "You're right." And it was stupid. I didn't need it. It was just a fear thing. Because stepping out with a lot of weight on your back in a squat is fucking scary. I don't care who you are.
Yeah.
It is fucking. When you step out and your hips giving it that waggle because it's that fucking heavy and you're having to really focus on holding your core to stop your hips from waggling about underneath the bar, when you start to unlock your knees with that weight, that is scary.
Yeah, it is.
It's a lot easier. It's a lot harder to push that weight to total failure. And I mean proper total failure.
Yeah.
Than it is to get under half the weight and push that to close to total failure.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. Absolutely.
And so that comes back to that. The effective training is the one you can do the best.
I try to find that balance though. So I don't want to go, you know, I don't want to use half that, but I might, you know, I try to use the most that I can, you know, I use the most that I can while still being able to take it to what you're talking about, that intensity level.
I mean, I've done 50 and 60 sets, rep drop sets on leg press and stuff like that, where I had no fear of injury. And I knew I could just push and push and push and push and push and push and push until it just fell on top of me sort of thing. It didn't matter.
Okay.
I remember once doing a drop set from 800 kilo down on leg press. That was interesting.
down to like next to nothing, you mean?
Down to 100 kilos is what I failed on.
Yeah. Oh my God.
I had to get pulled out of the machine and just sort of dragged across the floor and left in the corner.
I bet.
But it's an effective training program is going to be one that you can adhere to. And you'll get guys that get growth out of what is probably not a particularly good program, but they get growth because they can hit it hard, because they can hit it with intensity, because they enjoy it or they believe in it. I do a lot now with biomechanics and levers within training and maximizing the load points on an exercise in order to stimulate the massive amount of stimulus of the muscle attachment to that load. And a lot of guys struggle with it because it's so alien to what they do and they don't enjoy it. Now, once they get committed and they start to see the response and start to feel the physical response that you get from it, then they do start to enjoy it. But initially, a lot are very resistant. And that ability to get behind that style of training is what makes and breaks them when it comes to having rapid gains in the training.
Yeah.
And if they can't attack it with any sort of level of intensity, then it's not going to work. You know, you can't tickle a muscle into growth. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
But back to rest, I very much say, listen to your body. Don't be scared to take rest. There's nothing wrong with that. And don't feel that you have to attend the gym. But at the same time, you've got to be self-disciplined enough to say, you know what, I feel like shit, but I'm going to go and give it a go. Because some of my best workouts have come off the back of feeling like crap. So go, give it a shot. If it's not, I always had this one rule: 3 bad workouts in a row, time off. If I didn't get, if it was one and then I was back to power and progressing, then fine. And I that was my mark. If I was progressing in the gym, even an extra rep or whatever it was, it didn't matter. But if I was showing some sort of progression in the gym, then I continued. But a lot of us can train a lot more than we realize. Where that will change slightly is if you can't eat.
Mm.
Because at the end of the day, what a lot of people don't seem to understand is our biggest expensive food. It's not drugs, it's not weightlifting equipment or whatever, it's food. And we use that food as an energy source when we train. And then we use that food as a recovery source post-training.
Yeah.
So we want to be as efficient as we can in the gym, otherwise we're wasting that money. And if you can't eat to support your training lifestyle or your growth, then for whatever reason, be it appetite, be it finances, be it workload, be it body type, if you can't eat more, then you have to train less.
Yeah. That makes sense. All right, Dave. Well, this has been a fun start here. I think we covered some good stuff, and I feel like the door's open where we have a lot more we could go into, a lot more topics we could talk about. We obviously have a lot more questions that we could answer. I encourage the listeners' feedback. Tell me what you think, guys. Let us know, you know, what we can do with this, what you would like to hear. And, you know, we want to try to do that, because at the end of the day, this is about entertainment, but it's also about education. And it's, I love getting different people's perspectives, and we've got a lot of cool perspectives at Advice is Radio. And, I've always really appreciated your perspectives, Dave. And it's fun to always bring you on and hear more of what you have to say. So I think this is a fun start, and, I had a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. And hopefully this will grow and people enjoy what we put out.
I think so. I have a feeling it will. We also have to come up with a name, or else it's just going to be Dave Crossland's podcast, one of the two. And I think either way, it's going to be successful. But nonetheless, I think something a little bit more catchy would probably work.
Yeah, well, I'm still sort of a fan of drugs and stuff at the moment.
Well, maybe that's what it is. Maybe that's what we'll have to go with. Well, listeners, what do you guys think? Drugs and stuff? Does that cover it? Of course, the end stuff is going to be a lot of training, because I have a feeling we're going to do a lot more training talk on this show. You know, everybody knows you as being the drug guy, but I know you as being a guy who's talked about a lot of the drug stuff, and you seem to be going back to your foundation more into the training stuff.
I've always been big into the training stuff. It's just something I've never really populated. It's something I've always had a big passion for. I developed some training programs a long, long time ago that I've seen grow in popularity of more recent years. And I'm just thinking, I was doing that 10, 15 years ago.
No kidding.
But I've always been a big experimenter when it came to the gym. And I would literally go and pick an exercise and do rep after rep after rep and move finger spacing an inch on one rep, elbow position an inch on another rep, head position somewhere else on another rep, and just constantly play and listen to what the body was telling me.
Yeah.
And focus. And then I started to realize there was actually some commonality between what changes I was making on different exercises and where the position of hands and elbows were in relation to muscle attachment and levers. And start to realize that there's this whole basic setup that works on any physique, any lever length, barring obviously injury restrictions, that creates a much more effective load at the target muscle.
I think that training and stuff doesn't sound as good for a title, though. What do you think?
No, I don't. I you know, the the meaning of life, the universe, and everything. But yeah. I don't. I have no idea. It's not something I'm particularly good at, really. We'll see what people come back feedback-wise at the end of this and see what they say.
Sounds good. So it's early evening over there in the UK right now. What do you got planned for the night?
I'm actually doing a podcast with Dave Palumbo.
Oh, no kidding. No kidding.
Yeah. Get RX Muscle in a minute.
Oh, really? What's the topic for this one?
EQ and T-Bow.
EQ and T-Bow. Mm-hmm. Give us the insight then before. Give it to us first. What do you say, yay or nay on T-Bow, first of all? Is that a drug you like?
T-Bow's, yeah, I think it's a very underrated drug. Unfortunately, the problem is that a lot of T-Bow has been D-Bow, which has put a lot of people off.
Oh.
But it's probably one of the most in the sports performance world study drugs there was. The Russians played around with this stuff.
Interesting. For years. Well, we'll have to tune into that.
There's a lot of stats on even low-dose stuff, 10, 15, 20 mg a day, and improvements on people's shot ports and javelin and such like. Good drug, doesn't aromatize, good all-rounder. Toxicity is quite reasonable for an oral. EQ, not a fan.
Not a fan EQ, huh?
No. I have had concerns with anything that starts pushing RBC up high.
Ah, that's about the only side effect I get from EQ. You know, I get nothing else, no like acne, no sexual side effects, not too much bloat, but you know what? Yeah, the red blood count starts going up.
I mean, that's what it's designed for, and it can be used to your advantage, but the problem is it takes a long time to come back down, and in the meantime, it is very, very damaging on internal organs when it's high, and I just don't think it's always about a risk-reward ratio.
Yeah.
Are the risks or the dangers with this drug worth the rewards I get out of it? And to me, high RBC, particularly over prolonged periods of time, can cause some major, major issues in the body, especially cardiac related, and heart malformation and stuff like that. And I don't think it's worth the risk for the benefits you get from it.
Fair enough.
If I was going to go for a drug that increased my RBC, I'd be more likely to pick Oxy because I know it's going to make me as strong as a fucking ox at the same time.
I'd be afraid to see you on that.
I once took a version of it called Synastron.
Okay.
It was supposedly Dutch. It came with a skull and crossbones on the side. It was registered as a poison, but Jesus Christ, was I strong on that stuff. I think I put about 40 kilo on me squat in like 2 weeks on that.
Oh, God. All right, guys. Well, on that note, let's cut out of here because that's the bestest place I think we can possibly end it.
All right, my friend.
All right, guys, for another episode on the Advices Radio Network of drugs and stuff, that could be it, with Dave Crossland. I'm Scott McNally. Guys, we'll see you soon.
Bye-bye now.
Advices Radio Network.